Session number 17747, reel 35.
I think you're saying that you had a period of some 6 weeks of training, which would be sort of working up again, getting yourselves fit and refamiliarized.
Yes, this was the theory. I mean, the army has to have things planned, and it has to have a sort of blueprint. And the blueprint for us was that, having had roughly a month rest, recreation, and reforming ourselves, then we had 6 weeks training. That was the theory, and this starting on the 1st of May would take us comfortably through to the middle of June, and no doubt somebody would have another bright idea starting in the middle of June. It does not seem to have been a very arduous training scheme. Everybody was doing a bit of everything. People were going on 48 hours leave into Cairo, staying in hotels, away from these tents. We were doing things like this houseboat on the Nile party. Training, in fact, was interpreted rather loosely. I noted the attack was going brilliantly in Italy on the 26th of May. Anzio was relieved at last. Went that evening to the Gezira Club. The Gezira Club is a remarkable thing in Cairo. It was the British officers' club on a big scale. There was everything there: squash, tennis, swimming. There was a cricket pitch. It was the colonial life writ quite large and ostentatious. Not too far from it, of course, was the world-class Shepherd's Hotel, where one would go and drink on the terrace. If you had lunch at Shepherd's, the first course would be 6 boiled eggs in sauce before you got down to serious eating.
Were you able to absorb this sort of scale of feeding after
being on
rations?
You can do almost anything when you're 22, but you do suffer for it. I've noted somewhere that 48 hours leave in Cairo was ruined by a bottle of gin, which we imbibed too copiously, and the relief of being away from the tents on the first evening. We spent the next day really just trying to sleep it off. And the conditions in some ways were quite appalling. I mean, we had these little tents, no air conditioning, no relief. It was getting to the hottest part of the year, and I noted in 23rd of May that the ham scene is at its worst. Sandstorms are blowing really burningly hot, and really physically uncomfortable and painful. No cover, you see. And I've put that, for example, up at 4:40, I don't know why, jeep to church parade. I'm in charge of the division artillery contingent. I was notionally, and indeed practice, a sort of Catholic in those days, and we had a service, open air church service in the Gezira, on the Gezira Island. For which we wear hats because of the scorching sun. I'd totally forgotten that, but we were ordered to wear our headgear
during
for a
devotions.
Church service. Uniquely. There was a flypast by the RAF. This was Empire Day, 24th of May. This is why we were doing these things. I then played squash for the first time, again, at the Gezira Club. And we had showers and baths, sat and watched a cricket match, and dined in the open under fairy lights with Bill Lowes and his friends, friend the Field's Ends. This was the colonial life, I've noted. This was pretty nearly the end of empire, but it flourished.
Did you have any ideas about that, about the empire being in its closing stages, you know, having read history?
Well, I think so, but I think that that one couldn't have foreseen it being the end being quite so imminent. I mean, the the signs were there that it was not impregnable, because I had an uncle by marriage, who was a rubber planter in Malaya. My young aunt had gone out to join him mid-30s, and of course when the Japanese invaded they both had to get out, and he got out on a sort of canoe or something, had a hairy time in the Indian Ocean for several weeks before getting home to Britain. She came home and joined the forces and became a Wren officer. But, I mean, their lives were shattered almost overnight as colonials, and one could see this was an early warning that it could happen. I think that we were all aware, and certainly, as you say, as history students, I had gone to talks in the evenings at Nottingham University by people like Krishna Menon, who spoke all the time about Indian independence, and indeed it had been promised for after the war by Churchill and Attlee.
The principle of home rule had been conceded in 1917.
Oh, yes, but independence was the bait which got the Indians into full support during the Second War, and indeed it was the very first act, I think, that Attlee signed when he became Prime Minister. I mean, Indian independence immediately. So, yes, I mean, all the warning lights were there, and this was this gave a sort of added piquancy to the unexpected experience of being part of this colonial drone-like existence. That side of the colonial, I'm not suggesting that was the whole of colonial life by any means, but this was the luxury side of it. And it was something to have experienced, however briefly, just for a week or two. I put in my diary, this is a novel way of life, a bit tired after three late nights, but willingly embark on a fourth one. This was irresponsibility writ large, and I hadn't known a great deal of this as a relatively poor boy growing up in humble circumstances and working quite hard to get on, and you find that there's a whole sort of stratum of society who live it up, and I dare say they still do.
Probably a different stratum nowadays.
Yes.
Did you find that while you were living this life as a drone, obviously it had its enjoyable features, did you find that in any way your conscience was troubled by the disparities in wealth?
No, totally. I mean, I was left wing. My conscience was everything, and I enjoyed it, but with a detachment. I was looking at myself enjoying it. And the enjoyment, I guess, was more limited than it might have been with some people for the reason you've given. I was pretty left-wing, and I wrote all kinds of heretical little bits of doggerel at these times, which would have had me cashiered in different, had they been uncovered.
Was there any sort of general political atmosphere within the regiment, or within the officers' mess in the regiment, of which you were aware at the time? Was politics ever discussed? And if it was, were there prevalent or predominant attitudes?
I think to those of us who were inclined to the left, we did well to keep our mouths shut, because the prevalent, the whole atmosphere was one of assumed right-wingism. It was just an assumption. I mean, it went without question. I mean, you would criticise in the time-honoured way the War Office and so on, but it was all within the club.
Well, brass hats and the staff have always been a target for soldiers in the field.
Yes, that's right.
Not really political, is it?
It's not political. This is, I don't know how you'd put, what adjective you'd apply to it. But, of course, in a place like Cairo, it was particularly marked, because there were major sort of headquarters staff. There were red hats, staff jobs, from time immemorial in Cairo. It was the major Middle East headquarters, It was a place for brass hats, and we were transients. They resented us for horning in on these luxuries and making the service at the Gezira perhaps slightly longer than it otherwise would have been because of our presence. We occupied squash courts and things, which they felt were theirs by right. There was as you imply, I mean, there was a non-political flavour to resentment of brass hats, and no doubt their resentment of us on quite different and more spurious grounds. We, of course, were wrong, I guess, in assuming that they were drones, professional drones. I'm sure there was a lot of serious and difficult work going on, planning.
Were you aware of there being any sort of political feeling amongst the soldiers in the regiment?
No, not at this point. This came the following year when we started, you know, when the war finished. Then political feelings were began to vent themselves, but not at this time. The general feeling was, I think, of amused suspicion and resentment of the Egyptians who were trying to rip us off at every turn. And this was felt no less by the gunners than by the officers. The spirit at this time was very good indeed. People were all relieved not to be in daily danger of being killed. And this itself mattered.
Did you find that while you were in Egypt and you were out of danger, you had disruptive memories of times of great danger?
Oh, yes, I don't think these leave you. But when you're young, you can set aside quite easily and different preoccupations take over. Some horrid things happen, of course. I mean, I didn't enjoy that business where the driver had to throw the bananas over the hedge. I felt that we were being brutes to poor little villagers who were only trying to make a living. But what could we do? We didn't want their bananas, and that was that. Also, I remember, and I don't like to think of it, but I remember going on an evening into the Gezira or somewhere else, Groppies or Maxims. There are all these well-known names, Shepherds, Groppies, Maxims, all symbols of luxury in Cairo, of people enjoying themselves. We went in a couple of jeeps, and I remember coming back to the Mina pyramids where we were based, which was then across about 8 miles of desert. Is now, I went back last year, is now simply an extension of Cairo with housing going right up to the pyramids. It's changed beyond recognition. 15 million people now live in Cairo. It's about four times what there were then. Coming back in a couple of jeeps, I remember the jeep in front of us. It had two captains and two lieutenants in, and we had much the same behind, and the front one actually ran into an Egyptian who was crossing the road. And I remember it being a dire situation because technically this should have been reported to the civilian authorities, no doubt the military one too, though I don't know exactly what technically should have happened. But in fact, we did nothing. We did the cowardly thing, got out and saw this man was lying unconscious, and got back in the jeeps and went away. It was too difficult a situation to take on more, and the chaps concerned, I don't excuse myself, though I was only a passenger in the second jeep, did nothing about it at all. I think this could reflect some feeling that the Egyptians at that stage were looked upon as second-class citizens, that what had happened to this chap mattered less than if it had happened to a Brit. No, I wouldn't like to build too, I wouldn't like to philosophise about this. I just remember it as something unpleasant which happened. Something bizarre which happened was that the second in command, our field cashier expert, who had a military cross and bar by this time, was heard in trouble in his tent, and we went to see what was the matter, and the poor man said he was seeing pigs in his tent, which suggested some mental or physical aberration. The poor man was obviously going slightly mad with the heat, as a lot of people were.
Had he been drinking, do you know?
Not excessively. He would have a drink, and he would get, if I remember rightly, he got tiddly rather quickly. But I don't think it was quite the same as, seeing white rats in corners. I mean, he was ill. He was taken off to hospital. I noted somewhere that I went and visited him in hospital, and I think he was there for a few days.
And this was just a hallucination.
That's right. I mean, it was a genuine hallucination. People were quite ill. I mean, I've talked about this man who died of enteritis. Other people were carted off with tummy bugs. I myself was ill for a time. And it was all... it was stressful. In a way, because the climate, I mean, this, we're talking about early June by now, and it was damned hot. I mean, it was going up to 125 and more in the shade, and there was no shade.
Presumably you had a sort of special regime of work for that time, where you'd work in the morning.
Yes.
Have a long break in the middle of the day. And
that's
work
right.
In the evening.
You have a siesta time and so on. It was a curious period. There's not a lot worth recording. We did an awful lot of reading. We must have had good access to books. I find myself listing various things that I read during this period and did quite a lot of reading and, of course, writing letters.
Well, do you know if these books were provided by a military library service or whether you bought them?
I think... Oh, we didn't buy them, no. They were sort of library. They were on loan. Yeah. I think that there were various charitable bodies operating in Cairo, and probably had long been operating, which provided books in the same way as there is a naval book service to ships. It's good to remember, in a way, that we had no problem in finding decent reading material. I mean, light stuff, things like Frenchman's Creek and so on. I was reading sort of quasi-history books by Hilaire Belloc.
Now, no one could accuse him of being left-wing.
Indeed not. No. This was my Catholic period, you see. I spent half a day reading Claudius the God, and so on. I haven't noted down, obviously, all the stuff. But we reading journals in the mess, and the mess, of course, was a big tented thing, very hot. But it was better protected against the sun than our tiny bivouac tents.
What about the soldiers? I mean, what did they do? Did they read, as far as you know?
Yes. It was too hot to do any active games, although there were occasional forays with footballs, trying to make the best of the cooler weather in the evening. To Groppi's, where Finnish Virginia Woolf's Orlando over iced coffee. I mean, if that isn't lotus eating, I don't know what is. meet Arno and the chess player Horn, fellow subalterns, and have a game of chess. He was a brilliant player. He was the heir to the Horn brothers, the tailoring establishment, and he was really a champion chess player in civilian life at his level, and he could take on half a dozen of us simultaneously. Very bright chap. Read Penguin short stories, and so it goes on.
How much notice did you have that this period of lotus eating was going to come to an end?
Well, there are odd notes. The 10th of June, the move, which I haven't previously mentioned, the move to Syria is called off. Oh. So we had been confidently expecting to go to Syria. And we were hoping we would, because there was no serious fighting going on there. We'd had quite enough of that, thank you. Another £5 missing from the impressed account. And then we note that the Second Front, this is 12th of June, Second Front seems to be going satisfactorily. The same day, 12th of June, the week begins with a CO's conference at 6:30 in the morning, as you rightly say, before the sun comes up. Our training is now to finish by the 30th of June, which cuts 2 months off our expected out-of-action period. This brings back to me the thought that we were probably intended to be in Egypt for about 5 months, April, May, June, July, August, and ending by the training period at the end of June was cutting 2 months off that. Spend all day, 14th of June, all day at the pyramids with a wireless truck supervising the gunner side of a regimental wireless scheme. The pyramids still amaze me, and I delve among the ruins. It went right inside the Great Pyramid, in fact, down one of the tunnels into it. Take one or two snaps and spend much time in an Egyptian police canteen, which I'd totally forgotten. And the following day to Beni Youssef. Now, I can't remember where that was, but it crops up in my diaries. To Beni Youssef with the CO and with Milne, a captain, I think, who gives a counter-mortar lecture.
Do you remember anything about the Egyptian police and their canteen? And
nothing at all. Absolutely nothing. Mm. Nothing at all. Presumably there is a fairly sizable police encampment near the pyramids, and there still is, partly to, presumably, in Egyptian terms, to protect the tombs or to be available to do that. They're still there. They're nowadays partly protecting tourists against pressing beggars. 16th of June, get everything ready and set out into the desert on a signal scheme. That's a scorching 3:30 p.m., a hectic 3 hours of RHQ, quote, in action. This was pretend battle. Then I'm suddenly sent back to take part myself in a 167 brigade, that's in our infantry brigade.
Use the fusiliers, weren't they?
That's right. There are two fusiliers and one queens, normally. Thus, I avoid the night exercise, the signal exercise going through the night in the desert, happily. Next day, up at 4:30, out to 167 Brigade. This is where it was, at Beni Youssef. Yes. So that's where 167 Brigade was. Take part in a ridiculous wireless scheme. Break off from this and spend the whole morning reading The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist. Evening out, nightclubbing, delve into some very dangerous, quote, wog alleys, but emerge unscathed. Coffee at Giza, 12:15 midnight. The next day, yet another wireless scheme. I do the CRA, Commander Royal Artillery Representative, and get several rockets for wrong procedures conveyed to me through a ghost monitoring station. So we were being invigilated on the air. I can't remember quite how this took place, but presumably somebody on the same wavelength was listening in to our exchange of signals.
You say the scheme's ridiculous. Why was it ridiculous? What?
I don't mean that. I should think I was just being... just venting my feelings about having to be involved in what seemed to be rather a waste of time. Training was always regarded as a bit of a waste of time. The absurdity of being made uncomfortable for long periods for no purpose. In short, I was not a professional soldier.
Bolshe,
yes. Yes, that's right. The whole life was ridiculous. That's right, Bolshe. The next day, yes, the third wireless scheme, rockets for wrong procedure. Hear about pilotless planes falling on England. This was the V1s.
Had you not heard of those before?
No, this was the first time. I don't know when they first appeared. This was 18th of June, 44. It's probably about the right time, isn't it?
Were you aware of what was going on in Normandy at that time? Because by that stage, we'd been ashore for some 12 days or so.
That's right, we had, yes. We followed the news, of course, with avid interest, because, you know, it concerned us. We didn't know we might be going back to join it.
What was the main source of information? You mentioned army newspapers.
Well, we did have the BBC, of course.
You had the BBC.
I mean, particularly, whether we could receive the BBC on our shortwave radios, our operational radios, I don't know. We certainly did manage that in Italy, presumably through what you call the signal stations, which were
relay stations.
Mm-hmm. But in case of Egypt, I'm sure that there was more than that. These were probably huge long-wave arrangements.
What about other press sources other than the military?
Well, there was the Egyptian Mail, the Cairo Times, or whatever it was called. I've got one or two copies somewhere in here. We got the newspaper, in short. It was rather like a small provincial newspaper in this country. And, of course, paper was not in great supply. I mean, if you've got a double-fold spreadsheet, sort of, not spreadsheet, what do you call the
broadsheet?
Broadsheet. That would be it. I can show you one or two later, if you like. Listen with interest to the Italian advance continuing. Obviously this scheme got under my skin because I wrote home and I then tried to recover from this stupid scheme. My thoughts were on my brother John, who's almost certainly now in Normandy. I'm reading quite a lot these days, as it seems to be a useful interlude for thought and philosophizing about life before we have to go into action again. This is the Observer looking at the subaltern. We're now surrounded, Monday the 19th of June, by hectic training, and rumours are rife. But what seems to emerge from this is that an early return to Italy is probably certain.
Did that news come to you on a specific occasion, or did it just sort of seep into you?
What, about Italy, early
about
return
to Italy?
To Italy,
yes.
It became the flavour of the day.
Yes.
It became pretty obvious.
Yes.
It would not be said officially for obvious reasons, but nothing else made sense.
What was the reaction to that, the idea of going back into Italy?
Oh, fatalism. It's the only word. I mean, nobody wanted to go back to that, the stuff we'd been through, but there seemed to be no alternative. And I noted at this time, or a week or two later, apart from these diaries, I wrote little bits, and one of the little bits I wrote was that we heaved sighs of relief on leaving Italy earlier in the year, and everyone had visions of going from Egypt to invade Greece or Crete or Yugoslavia. As usual, things have turned out to be more commonplace than expected, and here we are, after twice setting out for Palestine or being told we were doing so from Egypt, but always staying in Egypt, we're on our way back to Italy. I hate the idea of going back to a life among the dead.